I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of who goes into those homes that are vacant due to foreclosure. Mimi Norris has to shovel out the kind of stuff you really don't need to hear described in detail. Mimi's been in the mortgage field service business for over 10 years, and she's never been anywhere near as busy as she is today. It's kind of bittersweet for her because she knows it's other people's misfortunes that are proving to be such a boon to her business.
I think about it. You know, someone has to do this job, so I don't feel bad or guilty about my job. But I feel bad that so many people are losing their homes.
Mimi Norris says that in many cases, she has to go to the homes of people who are still there, people who can't pay and haven't left. Mimi says she brings her own personal perspective. There was a time when she and her husband and children lost their own home to foreclosure, so she knows what they're going through. I'll talk with Mimi after the news. The very last person that some people see before they lose their home is Mimi Norris. When they stop paying the mortgage, when their home is close to foreclosure, Mimi is sent in to talk to the owner. Sometimes, she says, the people inside are frightened. Sometimes they've already left. Mimi knows what they're going through. Years ago, she and her husband and kids lost their own home.
We never went back. We never went back. We had moved to an entire different state. We were afraid, too, because of what the credit people, when they call, the collectors, say. They get very nasty. We're going to throw you out. We're going to foreclose on you. We're going to kick you out on the street.
Mimi has been in this business of looking after these foreclosed homes since the mid-90s. In the last year alone, her workload has tripled. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
There were over 14,000 foreclosures in the Chicago area last year, 13,000 in the Twin Cities. And as tough as that is on those homeowners, it still doesn't compare to what's happening in states like California and Florida. Ohio recorded 153,000 foreclosure filings last year.
Big cities across the country are seeing a big jump in the number of people losing their homes.
The tsunami of foreclosures occasioned by the subprime mortgage crisis is threatening to inundate a number of people, thousands even in California.
We're reviewing whether or not to ask the governor to call a state of emergency to respond to this crisis.
Imagine scores of homes with for sale signs flapping in the breeze, and more people spending half their income on mortgages or rent. And even fewer able to qualify for a home loan.
Mimi Norris runs a company in Norton, Ohio. They call her work Mortgage Field Services. It's Mimi's job to drive out to the house to find out what the problem is.
Sometimes you're knocking on the door, asking the homeowner if they've spoken with their lender lately. Try to get the information from them as to what's happening, why maybe the lender hasn't received their payment.
So in these cases, maybe you're working on behalf of the bank or the mortgage company. They haven't got their money and they want to know why. Is that what's going on?
Yes. Yeah. The lender wants to know where the money is, and it's our job to go and find out, you know, is there a current phone number? Maybe the phone number's changed. Maybe the payment was sent out and it's been lost. There's a lot of different reasons. It's not always that the person cannot make the payment.
I wonder if it's also dangerous work. You're kind of showing up like the sheriff, right?
Yes. Well, not so intimidating. A lot of people are genuinely shocked to have somebody from their bank knocking on the door. And that's what they perceive you to be. They don't understand the whole independent representative part. If I say your lender sent me out, they think that I work directly for that lender. I've been asked, do I know so-and-so in this and that department that they've spoken with? When you go back to your office, will you tell this person this and this? And we don't work right there with that lender. I've never seen a lender. I've never met one. I've never been inside their offices.
Was there ever a time, Mimi, when you were threatened at a house like that?
I did go to a house one time, and there was two Dobermans that I saw. One was chained, and one was in a pen. So I kind of assessed that situation. Is it safe for me to get out of my car? And I saw that the chained dog was chained closely enough that I could bypass him, and of course the other one was penned, so he wasn't going to be able to get to me. When I reached the door, I saw a third dog, and he was on a chain that was actually long enough to reach me at the door. And I don't even remember how I got back to my car.
But you did.
I got back to my car, you bet. And from that point on, if I saw animals, I just did not get out of my car. It's just not worth that.
What about homeowners threatening you? Nobody ever said, you got you and the bank, you're all such, you know, get off my property type of thing?
I had one rather cantankerous gentleman, and I just backed off and said, you know, that's fine. I'm sorry to have disturbed you, and went back to my car. And person doesn't like the bank, has angry words. I've learned not to go into the houses. I did that once. It was a rather chatty person. I think it was there for 2.5 hours. I just could not get out of there. She was pleasant. There was no issue. I wasn't afraid. I just couldn't end the conversation. And you don't get paid for 2.5 hours with one person. So I learned real quick, you don't go inside at all. Not if you want to make any money.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Mimi Norris does the one thing that a lot of large institutions can't or choose not to do. She listens to the people who are losing their homes. She hears their stories about why they've fallen behind in their payments.
There was a gentleman, he was a veteran, and he just didn't know what to do. He said the person at the bank told him there was nothing. And he had been in one of the more recent wars, then settled in and purchased his home with his VA certificate. And I had been in a similar situation many years ago and didn't know until it was too late that the VA will reach out to their veteran borrowers and try to help them as best they can to save their home so the veteran doesn't lose the home. And I was trying to relay that to him. I didn't want to see this veteran who had been in a war for us lose his home. And I tried to give him as much information as possible. Later, a month or two or three, I went, and he had got scared, and he'd moved out and left his home. And that, to me, was the saddest thing.
Because he didn't really have to lose the place.
He didn't have to lose it, no. I don't think he had to lose it.
Young guy?
Between 30 and 40. Wife, I think he had one or two children.
What's the similar situation that you had, if you don't mind me asking, Mimi?
My husband at the time had been in the military and had become injured right after we had purchased our home. It had been very stressful. I had a new baby. The collectors, they can be so terrible when they call. So I do understand the people when they tell me how bad these collectors are when they call. And so we just knew that under the circumstances, there wasn't going to be a way for us to meet the mortgage payments. So we did leave. And about a month or two after we left, a gentleman from the VA itself, the VA Department of Veterans Affairs, called and said, do you want to save your home and stay in it? And I said, well, we're already gone. We're a long way from home now. And he said, well, there is a program that we can help you stay in the home if that's what you want. And we just felt that it was kind of silly at that point. We had moved very far away from it. So they cleared out the debt with the lender.
Did you get to keep that place or did you never go back?
No, we never went back. We never went back. We had moved to an entire different state. We were afraid, too, because of what the credit people, when they call, the collectors, say. They're very nasty.
Yeah, what do they say to you?
Oh, they're horrible. They call constantly, for one, and they want to know why you are not paying the mortgage. They want to know, why did you even take the mortgage in the first place if you didn't intend to pay it? And it's, you know, when something happens, that's just so silly. Nobody takes out a mortgage with the intent of not paying it that I know of. They get very nasty. We're going to throw you out. We're going to foreclose on you. We're going to kick you out on the street. They saw all kinds of very bad, nasty things. So I do understand when the people tell me that the bank is calling constantly and making threats to them that, yeah, that's probably what happens.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about having gone through the experience of being hounded by creditors and having to leave a house, just walk away from it, even though you own some of it, because here you are now kind of doing the same thing for the banks and the mortgage companies. I wonder how that changes the approach that you bring if you're, you know, going to do an inspection or if you're talking to someone who's in a predicament that's so familiar to you.
I try to be more understanding of the different stories that I hear, and where I can be helpful, I try to be. I'm not as callous. There's so many things that can happen to each of us that would put us out of our homes. You just don't know what's going to happen. I remember a gentleman, again, it was interesting. He was also a veteran. his son had been run over playing. I guess he had jutted out, so it wasn't the driver's fault, but it had injured his son in such a manner as to put them in a lot of debt and made it that he was unable to meet his obligations.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder what that's like for you, though, to see people at that moment of stress. And I always do wonder, like, you know, did they land on their feet? Did they land at all? Where did they end up? That sort of stuff.
I think about it. I don't know about other inspectors, but I do. I think about it. And I wish them well.
Mimi Norris says it's one of the things that's most frustrating for her, never really knowing how these stories end. For example, she told me she never learned what happened to either one of those two veterans she was telling me about. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Mimi says there are often homes that have been abandoned. When squatters have moved in, her cleaning crews will wear hazmat suits and masks and goggles and heavy gloves.
There's we call poop rooms. They've decided one of the rooms is the bathroom, and not necessarily the bathroom. There's drug paraphernalia and things like that, used condoms. It's sometimes really disgusting going into these places where the squatters have come, and they leave for a little bit, and then they come back at night, and we don't ever see them, but we see the signs of them.
And so what do you do? Change locks, plywood on the windows? What do you do?
Everything you can to keep them back out, yes. Board the place, change the locks, padlock it. We had one house that was constantly being vandalized, and we actually put these big bolts through the door jamb and everything, and then through the door, so we had the whole system chained. And then finally, they weren't breaking into that house again.
Are you also finding that there are people who leave a home behind and leave all kinds of stuff in the home?
Sometimes they leave things. We'll go in and there might be a chair, a bureau, a table. I really get upset when I see children's toys left behind. It just breaks my heart. I think of my own self leaving my home with my little children and how attached they were to their own toys. So I really get touched by that. Why the homeowner did it? Don't know. I can only hope that the children had grown up and didn't need it anymore. Or you hope the child's grown anyway. I do.
Mimi says she didn't set out to run one of these mortgage service companies. It's like what happens with so many of us. She met someone. She liked him. He did this work. She got drawn in. I'll talk more with her about how she handles this new rush of foreclosures today. In just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. The record number of foreclosures this past year will be the subject of a meeting in Washington today. Senators on the Banking Committee plan to ask some tough questions of government regulators. Chief among them, why weren't you guys watching more carefully when banks and lenders were offering up all these mortgages and loans? And while that's going on in the halls of power, Mimi Norris will have her cleanup crews in the hallways of the men and women who have lost those homes. Mimi's in the mortgage field services business in Ohio. When a lender tries to contact a mortgage holder and receives no reply, it's Mimi's job to drive out to that house to find out what the problem is. It's a job that often surprises her.
Strangely, I see a lot of people that are more protective of their vehicles than their homes.
Take my house, I want my truck? Come on.
On occasion, I do those type of inspections where you haven't made a car loan payment. So they're much more protective of their car, yes, than they are their home. And I can halfway understand that because you can always find another home somewhere. But your car, you need to find your job. Mm-hmm. You need it to get your children to the doctor. Mm-hmm. You need it to get yourself to the grocery store or where have you. So that car is vital.
I asked Mimi what it was that drew her into this line of work. She told me that soon after a divorce, She met a guy and, without really knowing what she was getting into, offered to help him clean up a house.
I was newly single at the time, went dancing on Sunday nights at a local dance hall, and met one particular gentleman that seemed more interesting than the rest. The more I got to know him, the more that I wanted to get out on a date with him and do something other than just being at the dance hall. But he was always busy. He never had any free time. So I kept questioning, you know, what was it keeping him so busy and what did he have to do? So it was just kind of my attempt to get a date that I offered to go with him to remove trash from my house.
You didn't really know what you were getting into at the time, then.
No, I didn't. There was garbage. There was feces. There was dead animals. Absolutely disgusting stuff that had to be removed from the house.
Well, why was this one particular house, what, I guess about 10 years ago, in just in such awful shape?
It was like a two-unit, double-family type thing that had been tenants in there. And I guess when the owner had lost the house, the tenants just kind of walked out, left their mess behind, and then it sat for a while. And there was broken windows, so rain and things like that were getting inside, making this kind of a wet muck that had to be removed.
What do you remember most about that job?
Really wishing that it was over and done with real quick, because I was kind of stuck there. We just stayed there until the job got done, and that was, I think, 1 o'clock in the morning, actually.
So how long did it take, all told?
All told, it was about 14 hours between the two of us. It was a long, long day.
Do you remember what the place smelled like?
No. I think I blocked that out. It was not pleasant. I'm a smoker, and I just smoked a lot to try to mask all the odors.
And did you wear protective gear, masks or suits or anything?
No. Back then, none of those things were a concern. There was very little talk of mold. I remember being in a house, and it was just black. Walls up and down were black. And you just went in and, you know, had some gloves and shovels and went to cleaning.
So this man that you were cleaning the house with, you enjoyed the day even though the day was awful?
Believe it or not, I did. And we talked quite a bit throughout the day and got to know each other quite a bit more. I got to learn a little bit about what he actually does. And so it was a lot of fun, yeah.
And you did it again?
I did it again. That was my way of getting dates. He had something to do, and I said, well, yeah, I can go do that with you. It wasn't that bad. Is it as bad as the last place?
I read somewhere that just in the past few months, the volume of work that you and other people who are in the field service agent work, the volume has tripled. Is that accurate?
Yes. For us, it has. Many years ago, they would have us change a lock, maybe change two locks, and do the winterization process, and maybe just remove the garbage. Now they want the damages repaired. There's a lot more happening with a single home than there was in years past.
Does that mean, in your mind, Mimi, that the lending institution, the bank, whoever owns the home at that point, is just expecting that there's going to be a time when they will be able to sell it again and get some of their money back?
Oh, yes. That's the expectation, that they will be able to recover some of that money loaned.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when you talk about streets that have 10 or a dozen empty homes on them, I'm thinking to myself, wow, when is that ever going to get that?
That's difficult. And, yeah. And a lot of times those areas, the properties end up being raised. The city comes in, demolishes them. You have a developer come in and redevelop the area.
And so are you hiring more people?
Yes. We've hired more people in the past couple of years than we did in years before.
It's funny, I was just thinking that you know, the kind of business that you're in is going to pay you benefits when a lot of people are going through hard times, and I wonder if you think about that much.
I think about it. You know, someone has to do this job, so I don't feel bad or guilty about my job, but I feel bad that so many people are losing their homes.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Mimi says one of the real changes she's seen in recent months is that she's no longer just knocking on doors in the scruffier neighborhoods of towns and cities in Ohio.
The class of people has changed. It's shifted from an occasional blue-collar neighborhood to a lot of the blue-collar neighborhoods to upper middle class and upper losing their homes. We've gone into some very expensive homes lately, $500,000 and more. A lot of really nice homes being lost. There was one home, and the woman was still living there. And there was a huge hole in her roof. She just didn't have the money to repair it.
And the water was coming inside her house?
Yes, as she was living there, yes. They, too, have lost their jobs. And what do you do when you're CEO of a big company and you're living the lifestyle that's commensurate with that, and all of a sudden your company's gone? You have no job.
What else have you seen change just in the last few years?
The volume of vacant homes. Say on any particular street on the east side of Cleveland, years ago, you might have one house that was vacant on that street. Now there's 10, there's 20, maybe 30 vacant houses on that street. And you just drive down and it has turned into like a ghost town because you've got all these vacant properties. They're boarded, the windows are broken, the grass is overgrown. And it's scary to you going down that street with all those houses in that disrepair. And, of course, the vandalism to the vacant homes. They're going after the wiring, pulling that right out of the wall. So you see these big lines up and across the ceiling where the wiring's been pulled out. They're stealing fixtures, those old cast iron tubs that have the claws. They'll take those out. They'll take anything. The old 1960s, 1950s style cabinetry from the kitchens that are all metal, they'll take that. The hot water tanks, the furnaces, the ductwork, anything that they can take and take to a scrapyard, they'll steal it. If there's aluminum siding on the houses, inevitably that's going to disappear because whoever it is that does this takes the siding off.
They strip the siding off it so they can
yes,
sell it?
Yes, the aluminum siding, yes, absolutely.
You'd think that would be sort of something that you'd notice if you were on the street. If somebody's, you know, tearing the siding off that house that's been empty for a few months.
I don't know how these people do this, to be honest with you. The neighbors never see anything. We even had a home. This was just unbelievable. I believe it was an 8-unit property, grand in its day. But it was in a lower-end neighborhood now and one of the low-income rental type things. Mm-hmm. And it was in an area that was getting bad. It wasn't necessarily already bad, but it was getting bad. And it had these huge oak pillars holding up second-story porches. There was four of them, just huge oak pillars. And the property went vacant, and some copper was being stolen out of it, the plumbing. They actually went in and started stealing the copper while it was still partially occupied so that people living in there did not have running water because the vandals had started dismantling the plumbing system with metal cutters or something. Go in and start chopping the copper piping out of the houses. And then one day I was driving by and something didn't look right. And as I was looking at the building, I noticed, wait a minute, one of the pillars was missing. The property was systematically dismantled by somebody in the middle of the night. Each of the pillars systematically disappeared until finally the porches just dropped and crashed to the ground. And I went to one of the neighbors and knocked on the door and I said, oh my God, what happened to the house next door? And they said, you know, I don't know. I thought there was an earthquake. Woke me up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was the building down on the ground. That's like a 20-foot pillar. Didn't you see a truck taking this 20-foot pillar out? Nope, didn't see a thing, just the house on the ground. But I think these people are in fear that if they say anything, then they will be the target of this. That it would be their house next to be broken into, even though they're still living in it.
Wow.
So they can't see anything because that puts them at jeopardy.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Mimi Norris runs a company that comes in when a home is slipping into foreclosure. Often it's her people who have to clean it or seal it up. She also told me earlier that she brings her own compassion to this because she's been through it. She and her husband and kids lost a home to foreclosure back in the 80s. And so I couldn't resist asking her, does she have any advice for people in this kind of situation?
I think a lot of people get scared and move out before they should. They should not move out of their home, not until
even
the sheriff
comes. Even if the creditors are calling, even if they're
bad. Mm-hmm. Don't move out. That property loses value so quickly when it is vacant and is subject to vandalism and more loss that the homeowner does themselves better if they just stay in that home until they're asked to leave. If they don't want to go through that whole eviction process, the sheriff will come and knock on the door and leave a note that there's going to be an eviction in so many days. If they just stay in their home until that note arrives and then move, they're protecting their house just a little bit longer, and they're protecting their neighborhood just a little bit longer.
Does it end up leaving you with more respect for the way we live or with less respect?
Oh, that's a tough question. There's times where I just don't understand the people, and I don't have that opportunity to ask them, why did they do this or do that? We see dead animals. I don't know why they left the animals. They're just left, and left without food sometimes, yeah. Without water. They die of starvation.
Because they're locked in the basement or locked in a room of the house?
Locked in the basement, or maybe not necessarily locked, but the door is shut, yeah. So they can't get out.
Yeah. Same thing.
But yeah, we've seen cats, dogs, a number of different animals.
What you've described to me is kind of depressing. I just wonder what picks you up, what gives you hope?
My own family. Certainly not the business. The business, it's not a pretty business. I mean, I try not to think about it. You've got to block it out when you walk in and you see something that's horrible. And I've cried. A couple times I've cried. It's just not right, but there's nothing I can do about it, and then I can only remove what the lender wants removed. Mm-hmm. So.
Mimi Norris is in the mortgage field service business in Norton, Ohio. We have some links on our website that might give you some more information, some more guidance if you're facing circumstances similar to those. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Yesterday, I talked with Wayne Goldman about the electric car he designed back in 1971. It was a car that almost made it into wide production, but didn't quite. It's funny to hear him talk about his experience driving that car back in the 1970s because it's so similar to what people say today, the first time they sit in one of these hybrid cars.
The strangest thing about driving an electric car is when you come to a red light because you don't hear anything. And then you start to say, does the car still work? So you tap the accelerator slightly, and then you hear the clicking sound of the solenoid cutting in, and then you just hear this whirring sound. Driving on the highway, it was just fascinating.
Like being in a glider on a plane, where all you're hearing
yes,
is the sound of the
yes.
wind going past
and you don't hear any noises. So what happens? You start hearing noises you hadn't heard before. You'd hear the disc brakes, you know, starting to touch, that type of thing.
And what about people who were standing beside the car when you'd come up to a stop sign or driving away?
Well, one of the problems is you couldn't get people to move. If you were in traffic, you didn't want to blow the horn, so you're going, excuse me. Nudging them out of the way.
All you needed was a big rubber bumper, and you could just gently push them out.
Yeah, exactly.
After Wayne Goldman told me the story about his electric car, a number of you wrote in with your own. Michael wrote in from L.A. with a story about his girlfriend. She's trying to go car-free, Michael wrote. She still has a red 97 Hyundai XL, but she's taking the bus, and she bought one of these battery-powered electric scooters called a motorboard to go shorter distances. Well, then the girlfriend in question, Catherine, took over and she added a few notes. She says, while I'm less car conscious than the average Angelino, that car, that 97 Hyundai, well, Catherine says it didn't help my image. But take a look at my ride. Now I cruise along in my scooter, earbuds in my ears, the wind in my face. As I bring the motorboard into the grocery store, a shopper asks to see the scooter. Marvels at the fact that it's electric, and it really is, and how I can fold it up and carry it around as I browse the bulk bins. When I scooter up to the door at work, a student tells me, that's so cool. And I have to admit, it's the first time this book-loving, knitting chick has ever come close to earning such a title. and I'm pleased as punch. Thomas from Iowa wrote to say, "We have the electric car that Wayne was trying to mass produce and get on the roads in the United States. We have a two-door car that goes 40 miles per hour and travels between 35 and 50 miles on a single charge. We also have an all-electric delivery van and an all-electric flatbed work truck." Thomas says he sells electric vehicles at his car store, and he went on to say, "I also drive an electric Zen car every day, even in the snow and rain. My electric car," Thomas says, "costs me $10 per month to plug in and drive, and I absolutely love it." Well, thanks to all of you who wrote in. We do appreciate the feedback and those stories. It is, after all, a great time to be talking about different ways that people are trying to navigate around the rising price and the ecological cost of fossil fuels. If you have a story or a suggestion of one that you'd like to propose to me, you can always go to our website at thestory.org and leave me a message there. You can call our toll-free telephone line at 1-888-966-9862 and leave me a message. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. If you know about our regular series we call Your Story, then you already know what these stories are. They are the stories you bring to me about a defining moment in your life, a moment that is permanently etched on your mind. The story that Shou Jiao Young tells is a little different, though. Her story is about a moment that she can't recall. It was Halloween, 7 years ago. She was an undergraduate in Champaign, Illinois. She just stepped off the bus after her final class of the day.
The last thing I remember is really wanting a barbecue tofu sandwich for dinner. That was literally the last thing on my mind.
You stepped off the bus and you could see your home and you're thinking, time to eat.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, my only plan was to get in my car, drive to the natural food store and get the barbecue tofu sandwich.
But you didn't make it. What happened?
I got off the bus. It was a busy intersection, and, you know, on campuses, people jaywalk all the time. But this intersection is busy enough that, you know, it was never a good idea to jaywalk. So I remember waiting on one of those triangular traffic islands, you know, where most of it is like a rusty traffic pole.
You're sort of halfway across, but not really, right?
Exactly. I'm maybe like a third of the way across. And so I'm waiting. The light turns green. I start walking, and I guess a guy driving a pickup truck ran the red light and hit me.
Did you see the truck coming?
I didn't. I had no idea.
So what's the last memory you have of that moment?
The last memory is literally the sandwich.
So I want a sandwich, I'm stepping off the curb, and blank.
That's it.
You've clearly had a chance to talk to people who were there. What did those people tell you they saw, the people who... There was a woman with you on that traffic island, right?
There was. And it was totally, totally lucky that she was there, she was paying attention, and she saw the whole thing. And, you know, her recollection is that the guy ran the red light, that I was totally in the clear, had the walk signal and everything, and that it was his fault.
What happened to you? What were you told happened to you?
I'm told that I went flying, and you know, I'm told that the doctors knew I was going to be okay when I got to the hospital, because I actually tried to get off the stretcher and I tried to walk. So they knew that there was no neurological damage.
You have no memory of that?
I have absolutely no memory of that. I don't remember if I was still in the coma. I was in a coma for 3 days. And I don't know if I was still in the coma or if I had come out of the coma. Because there was a period after the coma of about 3 weeks or so when I was sort of like semi-conscious, half-conscious. And there I have little snippets of memory. But what's hard about it is I don't know which of those memories are my own and which of those memories might have been manufactured sort of as a composite of everything that everyone's told me about what happened. Like, I remember screaming and crying when they pulled the staples out of my head, because that really hurts. And I remember sort of seeing slash hearing the Bush v. Gore election returns.
I mean, I've had anesthetic that, you know, put me out for a hospital stay, and that really is like the black curtain comes down and I remember zero until I wake up in the hospital room. Was your experience of the 3 days of your coma just as blank as that?
Basically. I mean, there was, you know, if we sort of do the math, there was the 3 days of the coma. There was about 9 days, I think, in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And then 3 weeks of really nothing.
This was 7 years ago, and you have had a chance to look back over it and talk with some people. I mean, as fascinated as I am by what the experience of a coma is, I can imagine that because it's such a blank space, you come out of it, and one of the things you discover is what it was like for everyone who's close to you.
It was horrifying for my parents. Like, I mean, my parents live about 2.5 hours from where I went to school.
Right.
And I mean, the way they tell it, it's horrifying. Like, they get a phone call saying your daughter was in this terrible accident. So they have to drive 2.5 hours. And I guess, you know, my mom was just crying the entire time. My dad tends to be a little more outwardly stoic, but I imagine he was a complete mess inside.
What was the physical damage to you, Sho? What did they see when they got there?
My pelvis was broken, and I had a crack in my head. And
and a few cuts and bruises.
Scrapes and bumps here and there. Right, right. And, you know, the hospital was really good about taking care of the big stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, in order to put the staples into my head, they shaved a small patch of my head. And I often think, like, why couldn't they have just shaved my whole head? You know, of all the opportunities in life to have a really good reason to have a completely shaved head, I missed my opportunity.
You know, it's fascinating to listen to you describe the experience, because everything that you're telling me is what you were told about what happened to you. This is, you know, this is all about you, and yet you're kind of like a third person in this story.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole definition of being in a coma, right? Like, the coma person has no clue what's going on. And it's everybody else who's agonizing and wondering and not necessarily being able to answer any of the questions they might have.
So what do you recall of coming out of the coma?
It was sort of like I snapped out of it.
It's not, you know, like soft focus we see in the movies where, you know, the faces slowly come into focus above the hospital bed and choirs of angels are singing and stuff like that?
There were no choir of angels. I can say that in my experience, no angels.
Okay.
I don't know if the lack of angels is...
It's a bad sign, Joe,
judgment,
I got to tell you.
Yeah, I know. Awesome. Thanks, Dick. That's
no,
really
it's all right.
Reassuring.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. So you sort of snapped? You went, oh.
The first thing I remember after the sandwich is it's like the week of Thanksgiving. And I just sort of suddenly came to and realized that I was at the doctor's office, sitting in a wheelchair, wearing an outfit I didn't pick out.
It's interesting that you were in a wheelchair in a doctor's office. I thought everybody woke up from a coma lying in the intensive care unit.
But if you remember, I was in the coma for 3 days,
yeah.
And then I was sort of like half conscious.
Okay, so this is where the first clear memory comes from.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, I guess I was just kind of pseudo-functional. Like, I had I had partial will, I guess. My mom sort of gets a kick out of... I'm a vegetarian, and my mom gets a kick out of the fact that she fed me chicken while I was half conscious.
Trying to
correct you needed the protein. Exactly. You needed the protein. You needed to heal.
Was she the one who picked out the outfit as well?
I'm guessing.
What were the family reviews of your behavior at the time?
The family reviews. I think, you know, my parents were mostly scared and a little embarrassed. You know, I would have classmates who would come to visit me in the hospital, and, you know, I just had no social filter, you know. So apparently I had some classmates who came to visit me, and I was like, and I said something like, I don't like her. Make her go away. And so my poor mom is like just apologizing all over the place for my bad involuntary behavior.
Right.
And, you know, but it's interesting because I guess we don't know how deep-seated some of those things are. Like, you take away the social filter, and, I mean, I think about that sometimes. Like, is that the kind of person I really was? Like, is that what I am
below the well-mannered girl my parents brought up?
Exactly. Like, a chicken-eating, friend-bashing, half-conscious person?
Hellion.
A hellion, is that what you said?
Hellion, yes.
But my sister makes no bones about the fact that she thought I was totally, totally bitchy. You know, she says, you know, and she's 4.5 years younger, and she was in high school at the time. And it was agonizing for her, too, because, you know, my parents actually didn't tell her about the fact that I'd been in this terrible accident until a couple, maybe even 3 days after the fact. And, you know, she immediately wanted to get on the train and come down from the Chicago area to Champaign. And when she finally got there, I wasn't myself, and I was hardly a sympathetic character, I guess. I mean, she says there was one point when I was talking to her, and all of a sudden I turned my back, and I farted, and I fell asleep. So probably mid-sentence, or I don't know if I said something snarky.
You turned into a man.
You said it, not me. I mean, I wouldn't have put it that way, but I guess it's okay if you do.
Yeah, I can say that. Was there a part of your own consciousness show that was observing this rather uncharacteristic behavior? Like, was there ever a period when you were going, ooh, I don't think I would normally have said that or done that? Or was this in that kind of gray period as you were coming out of the coma?
That's another one of those things that's hard to say. You know, did I really have sort of the classic out-of-body experience? And I'm using massive air quotes here,
which
no one can see on the radio.
I saw them.
But did I have the classic out-of-body experience, or is that manufactured too? Like, again, based on having to assemble all the bits and pieces that people have told me.
Is there a second or a third stage here where you stepped out of the kind of foggy zone into what you now know to be the life that you're living now? I mean, was there a second kind of blah of the, and, you know, here I am back?
After I came out of the fogginess. I mean, I came out of the coma, came out of the fogginess, and, you know, maybe it's a coping mechanism of some sort, but I just sort of, you know, proceeded with my life as I had planned it. You know, I had classes to finish up, and my professors and TAs and everyone was, my classmates were all so, so generous in, like, helping me do that, giving me notes, helping with projects, letting me take take-home versions of exams, and you know, I had a lab class I had to finish up, and I remember the instructor came in on a weekend to sort of help me hobble around the laboratory. And this was a laboratory where there were highly toxic chemicals, so probably not the best idea for someone to hobble around on crutches. And so, you know, I finished my classes, I had a job lined up in Colorado, and I just sort of powered through everything.
I'm talking with Sho Jiao Young about the 3 days she spent in a coma. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story from American Public Media. Sho's experience has changed the way she sees her own life, that and the fact that other people in the hospital around her weren't as lucky as she was.
My parents have stories of other patients they would see when they took me to therapy when I was half conscious. And, you know, there were people whose pelvises were completely shattered. There were people whose pelvises had healed, but their doctors maybe weren't so conscientious, and they ended up having one leg shorter than the other. As far as I know, my legs are the same length, and I have no pain, no shattering. I mean, there's a crack in my pelvis, but you know, on a day-to-day basis, like it doesn't act up. So, and I don't even it doesn't even predict rain. So, I mean, it's sort of like a useless crack in my pelvis. I know. What's the point, pelvis?
Do you live your life any differently today, Sho? Do you ever think to yourself, I was just about roadkill 7 years ago. Why not go skydiving? Or, you know, no, I'm not going to go skydiving.
I mean, it sometimes helps to be a card-carrying coma person.
Why? Because you can just say, oh, I'm sorry, I was in a coma some years ago. I forget. What were you saying? Or...
Right. Dick, you're boring. Oh, wait. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that. I was in a coma.
It's the coma. It's the coma talking, honey. It's the coma.
It's the coma talking. And why don't I run faster? Because I was in a coma. No, I mean, it comes down to sort of like the, like in thinking about all of the people who helped me as I was, you know, coming out of the coma and trying to put my life back together. I remember getting, like, really nice messages from these people I might have thought were, you know, I studied engineering, and so, first of all, not a lot of girls in engineering, and sort of the classic stereotype of the engineering boy is that they're awkward and sometimes arrogant, and also that they're smelly. So, like, all these boys I'd sort of judged as varying combinations of awkward and arrogant and smelly, they wrote, like, these really nice notes. One of them, I don't remember even really paying attention to, wrote, you know, sorry to hear about the accident. Get better soon. Class just isn't the same without you. And I guess I'm more awake to life in the sense that I realize that, I mean, I try to pay more attention to people. I guess I realize that other people may be paying attention. So just because I'm not paying attention doesn't mean that somebody else isn't.
Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Though our friendship ceases from now on. And if you can't say anything real nice, just don't talk at all. That's my advice.
Sho Jiao Young is not gone. She was just away for a period of time. Thanks for sharing that memory of your coma, Sho. Brought to you with the help of a few friends who I gather remembered a little bit more of it than you did.
Carry on. Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Please don't talk about me when I'm gone. Though our friendship ceases from now on. And if you can't say anything real nice, just don't talk at all. That's my advice.
And if you have a story about something momentous in your life, you can let me know. Go to our website at thestory.org. Even if you need the help of some friends to stitch it all together, we'd be happy to hear from you. I hope you get a chance to join us tomorrow. I'm going to talk with Dr. Joe Lucy from Congo. Dr. Joe travels to some of the most dangerous and traumatized area of his war-torn country, particularly in eastern Congo, setting up field hospitals and clinics to treat war victims. He also deals with women who are victims of the sexual violence that's committed by men.
All these ladies, they cry to say, why didn't they finish me up, to chop my head off? What they want is not to live like this. They want them to have killed them. So I am so proud to say the biggest victory has been we have introduced this law in our constitution. It has been wholeheartedly voted by the whole nation that the most maximal crime you can commit in Congo is to rape a lady. And for me, it has been my biggest stamp in my life that I have at least achieved something for the whole ladies of Congo.
That's Dr. Joe Lucy. He's the man behind the organization Heal Africa, and he'll be talking with me tomorrow from just outside his office in Goma in eastern Congo about the work that he's doing there. If you have suggestions about people who have a story that you'd like to hear on the program, make a recommendation, get in touch with me, go to our website. You can find me at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.